This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the mid-60s, Mary Ann Faithfull was famous for two reasons. First, for her hit, As Tears Go By, which was co-written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Second was for her relationship with Mick Jagger. They were lovers. She was beautiful and waif-like, and she lived in the middle of a scene of parties and celebrities that zillions of teenagers yearned to be a part of. But by 1970, she and Jagger had split up. Her heroin addiction got out of control and eventually left her homeless. She began a comeback in the 80s with records that showed her off as a fine rock interpreter of cabaret material. Now she's written a memoir, and there's a new Best Of CD featuring such songs as Broken English, Strange Weather, and As Tears Go By.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play.
Something I found very interesting in your book, when you were in rehab in about 1985, you said everyone, as part of the therapy, everybody would tell their own story.
Mm.
And at that point, you realized that you had no idea what your story was.
Mm.
You felt a part of like the whole Rolling Stones scene's story about that whole, you know, the whole,
yes,
the scene, but you didn't know what your personal story was.
That, I think that's one of the saddest things in the book, that bit where I'm in Hazelden and they asked me to tell my story, and I actually rang Ellen Smith, my publicist, and said to her, please send me up and down with the Rolling Stones because they want my story.
Which was a book about the Stones.
Yes. That's what I, that is sort of very telling, you know.
What led to that feeling that you didn't know what your,
well, I didn't know
was,
when I said that I didn't have a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still thought that my story was the same story as the Rolling Stones. I didn't figure this out for another year. I'm very slow.
So tell us the story of how you met Mick Jagger.
Well, I went along to a party with my first boyfriend, John Dunbar, who was a friend of Peter and Gordon. And Paul McCartney was going out with Jane Asher. It's so hard to remember all these things. And somehow, John was always up for a party, you know, he's still like that, sort of. And especially then when we were very young, I mean, I was 17, and he must have been 19, you know, 19, 20, no more. But, you know, it was just a party, but it was a dead glam party, I suppose, even for London. And it was a lot of fun, I suppose, yes. I mean, it's somewhat sort of coloured in my imagination now by the fact that I was discovered there. But
what do you mean you were discovered there?
I was well, that's where Andrew Oldham saw me. I was discovered by several people at that party, actually. Andrew Oldham is the only person I gave my address to.
And he was the producer of your first records,
yes,
and of the Rolling,
yes,
Stones.
He managed the Rolling Stones, made their early records.
Now, what did he discover in you? Was it your look, or did he know that you sang?
No, he didn't know I sang. Now, that was just a sort of bit of luck, I think. I don't really know, even now. I mean, obviously David has asked him, and it's one of the best bits I love in the package of the compilation.
This is David, your co-writer.
David Dalton, yes. It's his business to find these things out. So in the sleeve notes, David wrote for Ireland for the compilation, it says, I saw an angel with big tits and signed her. So presumably that's what Andrew saw.
In your memoir, you reprint a press release that was written for when As Tears Go By was released. And it says, Mary Ann Faithfull is the little 17-year-old blonde who still attends a convent in Reading, daughter of the Baroness Orisso. She is lissome and lovely with long blonde hair.
Lots of alliteration in this press release,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yes. A shy smile and a liking for people who are long-haired and socially conscious. Mary Ann digs Marlon Brando, Woodbine cigarettes, poetry, going to the ballet, and wearing long evening dresses. She is shy, wistful, waif-like. Now, what did you think of that image of yourself?
I thought it was a hoot. I remember taking it back to my mum. and sitting in Milman Road reading it to my mother and Chris, my brother. We just fell about laughing, you know. I never in my wildest dreams thought that people would think I was like that. Although I did dig Marlon Brando. That's true. And I was at a convent. And my mother was a baroness. But apart from that, but then again, you know, I can't be too sort of sticky about this because it's quite obvious that none of us really see ourselves as others see us.
My guest is Marianne Faithfull. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Marianne Faithfull. You write, the sexual side of life was never easy for me to handle, but I'm not really that interested in sex. That struck me as very interesting because...
you're the first person to spot that.
But so much of the book is given over to your sexual life and your relationships with men and women.
Of course.
So it was hard for me to imagine you in that situation while you were thinking that, on the other hand, you weren't really that interested in sex.
It was fair. I mean, you have to remember, I wrote this book, it took 2.5 years ago, so it was me now that's writing this book. I do know that in the 60s I must have been much more sexual than I am now. But I think it was a very sexual time in the 60s. There was definitely what dear old David Dalton calls the zeitgeist, which I like very much. It was a very sexual thing, that zeitgeist. At least it was in London.
There are kind of like interesting sexual chapters in your family history.
My great-great-uncle Leopold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your great-uncle was Leopold Baron von
Sacher-Masoch.
Yeah. And so he wrote the novel Venus and Furs, and the word masochism comes from his last name.
Yes, he gave his name, gave our name to masochism.
And then your grandfather on your father's side was a sexologist.
Yes.
Who invented something that he called the frigidity machine to unlock libidinal energy.
Well, you know, these stories about poor old Theodore are actually all my mother's stories. I don't really know. I didn't check with my father because I just thought they were so funny, the frigidity machine and the whole thing. I wanted to keep it as my mother told me. But I'm not quite sure if he really was a sexologist. He might have been a psychiatrist or something. My mother would have thought that, though.
I'm wondering what impact you think it had on your development sexually to have these men
weird.
In your family.
Uh-huh. I remember when I was little getting a present from my grandfather Theodore, and it was a book, I suppose it was a sexology book. I mean, I never thought about it before, but it was called Letters to Margaret. And it was sort of like your first book about sex. It was incredible. And I found it very dull.
You write that once you get involved in this really sexual scene, to catch up, you bought books about decadent sex.
I did.
And these weren't the books from the men in your family.
No. No, Venus and Furs would be useless in that sort of
Was it more
situation.
Of a textbook or something?
No, it's not.
I never read it, I'll confess.
Well, it's very dull.
Uh-huh.
But it's sort of interesting, I suppose, in a sort of sociological way. But it's nothing like as interesting as the Marquis de Sade.
So is that what you read, the Marquis de Sade?
I did, yes.
So how did it affect your sense of yourself and your circle?
I was very shocked by the Marquis de Sade. I really was. I really was very shocked. It didn't directly affect me and my circle. I don't know. I suppose what it did with me was give me a sense of that this wasn't all real, that it was like a game. It was like a play we were in. And it was nothing to do with me. But I suppose by reading all these things, it gave me some idea of what the script might be.
Now you ended up doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of heroin. How did you start doing heroin?
I used it as a coping mechanism, I think.
For coping with what?
For coping with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for a while, but it did have a tremendous drawback, which was that it was addictive and it would kill you.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
Ages. Very long time. But I did figure it out eventually, thank God.
Now, I want to play a song that you wrote the lyrics for called Sister Morphine.
Mm.
that was released in England in 1969. Tell me a little bit about where you were in your life when you wrote the song and what the lyrics are about.
I don't know. It's a very weird thing about System Morphine because, you know, it was knocking about the house for 6 months. Mick was playing it all the time.
Playing the melody.
Playing the basic thing, da 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 da, that thing all the time. So it went into my sort of whole sort of nervous system, blood, bones, whatever, everything. I really had it in my I knew it by heart. Let's say that anyway. And then I remember it, and I'm sure Mick does too. It was very peculiar. I just sat down, picked up a legal pad and a pencil and wrote it out, you know. And there it was. But I do that sometimes. It's obvious. I work on it in my head. And then when it's all ready, I do it.
Why don't we hear System Morphine? This is Marianne Faithfull, recorded in 1969. Marianne Faithfull is my guest, and she's written an autobiography called Faithfull. The record company, Decca, you say yanked this record about 2 days after it was released.
They took it off the shelves.
What was their objection?
Well, there were many. The lyrics were very ahead of their time. It's one thing for Lou Reed to sing heroin, obviously. It was completely... This is something I really didn't understand, that this thing about me being this beautiful little angel was real. I never really believed that. I couldn't believe it. So I suppose for Decca, you know, the last thing they put out by Marianne Faithfull, I can't remember what it was Summer Nights, say. I think it was. That was in 1965. And then in 1969, they're given System Morphine. And they couldn't handle it.
You say that after you became a junkie that it actually brought you anonymity that you hadn't known since you were 16, since 17, that is. You were living on the street. I'm sure that wasn't exactly, though, the kind of anonymity that you wanted.
Well, I hadn't wanted celebrity in the first place. I just went to a party and got discovered. And I hadn't had time to think about whether I wanted it or not. So the anonymity I got in the street was very valuable to me.
Where were you living? How did you live during those years?
Well, I lived on a wall. I lived on a wall in Soho. And it was an amazing time for me. When I really couldn't take it, I could always go back to my mother's. You know, it wasn't like I had nothing. I wasn't exactly the same as the street people. But they didn't mind that.
I have one last question for you. You know, in your book you say that when you were in drug rehabilitation and everybody was telling their story as part of the therapy, you realized that you didn't know what your story was. Do you feel differently about your life and your story
very
having
much
sifted
so.
Through it to write this book?
Yes, that's been very, very beneficial for me. I mean, I have got a story. I still don't understand it all, actually. I mean, you have to check in with me in a year's time. But it's still sort of filtering through, you know. It's not like I understand everything. I don't. I understand a few things about myself. Like, I know I can't take drugs, and I know various things about myself. But I don't really understand all the positive things in this for me. But I will.
Marianne Faithfull, she has a new memoir and a new CD retrospective. Both are called Faithfull. This is Strange Weather.
World is getting flatter. The sky is falling all around. And nothing is the matter. For I never cry in town. And a love like ours, my dear, is best measured when it's dark. And I never buy umbrellas, for there's always one around. And all over the world, strange. Only about the weather.
This is Fresh Air.